Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Edwin Lee Gibson,
who is starring in the new play, the drama Turn Me Loose, now at Arena Stage, September 6th through October 14th, so about a week in, I guess. So thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Now, obviously, this is the story of the legendary stand-up comedian Dick Gregory. He just passed away recently, right? About a year ago?
A year ago, August 19th of last year.
Yeah, so about almost exactly a year ago. I had a chance to see him at Warner Theater. He came probably a few months before he died. He still had it. Still hilarious.
Yeah.
But anyway, so what are your memories of growing up seeing him long before you ever knew you were going to play him in this?
Yeah, yeah.
What were your first impressions, or when did you first encounter him?
Well, I first learned about Baba Gregory when I was like 10 years old back in Houston. And I learned about him as, through his diet, you know, the Bohemian diet. And learned about him as an activist later on. I didn't learn about him as a comic until I was like 13. And I was like, wow, he did all this stuff. And so, since I was 10 years old, that was my first introduction. And I've kind of tried to follow that path as an artist and as a man since.
Probably good you didn't hear the comedy until you're about teenager. That was probably better suited for some of the material.
Well, you know, my uncles were saying the same things, just not the same way.
Yeah, exactly. He had the better delivery, let's say.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, so since this is his life story, how much do we actually chart here? Like, what's the time frame throughout this piece? Is it from boyhood to man? And I assume we cover all of his activism as well, but, you know, give me a sense of sort of the time span here.
Well, the snippet, it goes back and forth. Yep. It's him in the 60s, and it's him in the now, the 2010s. It's him in the 70s, and it's him in the 2010s. So it goes back and forth. It kind of gives you an idea who he was as a comic, and kind of just that trajectory that he was on. And so he talks about his, in the now, he talks about his life then.
Right.
And then we go back then and we hear how his comedy really was and how it morphed, and then who he, and then the choice that he made to first use it as a mechanism to support the civil rights movement, but then realizing that he had to go full throttle into the civil rights movement and actually leave comedy behind and leave millions of dollars along with it, because he was the number one nightclub act in the country at the time.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm putting a pin in that because I want to unpack something with that. But even before we get to that, remind our listeners how he even got into comedy in the first place. Was it while he was in the military, or was he a postal worker?
I think he was in the military. I'm not sure exactly on that. I don't want to tell you something not accurate because it's going out into the airwaves. I don't remember exactly, but I think it was military.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I believe he's first starting to perform. I mean, it's probably segregated nightclubs at this point, right? And I feel like he was one of the first ones to break over and to cross over.
He was back in Chicago, and he had, you know, was really working the scene because he grew up in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And then Hugh Hefner saw him, booked him at the Playboy Club in Chicago. And from then, from that one night, it became a 6-week stint. And from that 6-week stint came a Time magazine article. It became, you know, just this heightened visibility, because, you know, you think about the segregation in the clubs then. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was performing to people that really didn't want to see him there, and he had no fear about jumping into the belly of the beast, as it were. And from that began to kind of change things from the inside. But you know, the one thing I think it should be noted is that he always had a certain style. I don't think the way that he saw the world, he wasn't trying to do a certain thing.
It wasn't some act for the show. He saw it. That was his
worldview. It was his worldview. And it's funny that the movement and this guy with this humor and this act would kind of like find each other, because he was already doing that type of act, but he wasn't doing it for that reason. He was just doing comedy.
Right.
Yeah. Which is very, very different.
Now, I want to go back to what you said a few seconds ago about how he was doing his form of activism through his comedy, in the belly of the beast, as it were. And we can't underscore enough the courage to do that, just to get up there, too. And you're winning hearts and minds literally by being on stage, peppering them with jokes. But then you're saying there came a point where he realized, I'm going to go full throttle into the activism. What do you know what it was that sparked that, and how's that reflected in the play?
In the show, it's reflected in we see him going from that longer stint in the Playboy Club, having his national write-up in Time magazine, and then having all of this access and this money and these gigs, and he began to go back and do charity speeches for organizations like the NAACP. And I think being part of that, realized how much people loved him, because, you know, the one thing he said was that he said he was always in the phone book, never had any bodyguards, because the people that he did comedy for, brown skin folks, liked him when he wasn't funny, and they pushed him, and they got him so good that they pushed him to places where they couldn't afford to come see him play.
Oh, wow.
So he knew.
It's like, we made you, and now you can't, now you're outpriced us in a way.
But we're right. But he never forgot those folks. You know, he understood the irrelevance of who those folks were.
That's a great point.
Yeah. And he had that going. And so when he began to go down south and do charity performances, he saw the relevance again for what his comedy could do, and he began to try to do comedy for that reason, just kind of being keeping himself accessible, to brown skin folks, and then found that he got deeper and deeper in the fact that he had to make a choice. Mm-hmm. That, okay, I'm at this point, I see this, I can't unsee it, I can't just do comedy then leave.
Right.
You know, and the more he kept going down, Medgar Evers, the late Medgar Evers, kept asking him to come back, and he went back, and he began to become this activist in a more direct way than he had been already with his comedy, you know, without even knowing it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, I'm with you every step here, man.
Yeah, yeah. And then
I'm just like, keep going.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then he left the comedy behind because he said, you know, I can't do both of these things. Mm-hmm. I can use it as the satire that it's always been, as the commentary that it's always been, but I've got to go full throttle into this activism. And then later in life, he was able to kind of come back.
Bring it back around.
Yeah, he was able to bring it back around. So, yeah.
Talk about how, I mean, you're saying he reached this point where he realized he couldn't just stay doing the comedy. He'd probably, you know, traveling around doing shows and things. He's like, I have a responsibility to do this more, and with adverts and everything. How does that play out in 2018 America, coming to watch this at Arena Stage? Why is now important for us? We're no longer just doing shows here. We're also urging society to wake up a little with shows like this.
Yeah. See, I don't think it's a new thing. Mm-hmm. I think what he did, some of the most relevant cats have always done. Richard Pryor was doing that. I mean, Richard Pryor, you know, who called Dick Gregory the master. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these cats pay homage
Oh yeah, wouldn't have prior.
Yeah, yeah.
Chris Rock.
I mean, especially when you think about
Eddie Murphy.
Especially when you think about the way that stories are constructed, the way that jokes are constructed. You know, you look at Dr. Cosby. You look at Richard Pryor. The way that those stories are told and the way the jokes are crafted. You look at George Carlin, you know, as well. So you have a whole line of people. Because at that time, I think it was really Lenny Bruce and Dick Gregory who were like the cats that were really doing something very different with comedy. I'm a Red Fox to a large degree as well, but those two cats on the nightclub level consistently, in all different houses. But I think now this seems to be a responsibility, but the great ones don't see it as a responsibility as much as I think they see it as just commenting on the world. I mean, you know, Silver Spring's own Dave Chappelle.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, who actually grew up knowing the Gregorys.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's a little tidbit. I mean, you know, you see a cat like that who feels a responsibility. I mean, you know, all the money that, you know, he walked away from.
Yeah. Same thing you just mentioned earlier, walking away from money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was some Dick Gregory type stuff there. Because cats don't do that. Now, because, you know, they don't have to.
Right.
Because they've got so much. So to do it is just such a shows his impact and how relative, how vital and necessary, you know, commentary is on just a large scale. So in the now, you know, and, you know, things are a bit. He was topical. He's topical now.
Always,
and it was topical then.
Yeah.
Which is really, 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 cool. So, to be able to, find that stuff each night, you know, to be right in that moment and say, oh wow, you know, I mean, you know, I have to be careful not to get caught listening to the show while I'm doing it.
Wait a minute, I'm the one on stage. Right, exactly. Man, he's good. Wait a minute, that's me.
Right, yeah. So it's one of those things that you get lost in it. So it's a ride. And he said a lot of things in the now that are relevant, but he was saying the same kinds of things then. Mm-hmm. To be able to come back and to still be revered the way he is, not, you can't say was, even in his passing, his transition, he is just amazing to watch, you know, when people come to the theater.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what, I mean, when you're talking about Chappelle and stuff, that's what I want younger, especially younger listeners listening to this who might be huge Dave fans, and, you know, come see the show to see where, I mean, all where a lot of this started. Like, let's see Dick Gregory's life and career and activism and see the seeds that were planted that grew into all these famous comics and activists that we know today.
Yeah.
How much of the show is, because you say it jumps back and forth sort of time, you know, now in the past and present. How much is actually, how much are you on there doing stand-up comedy? How much of the show, is it like little snippets here and there? Or?
Oh, man. Well, there's, the first two scenes are acts. One from the 60s and one as an old man in the now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah. Probably the one I saw.
So that happens. There are 9 scenes total in the piece. And I think, 4 of them you might consider, stand up acts. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, about 12 to 15 minutes each. But the cool thing is that I think you kind of get lost in it and you don't really realize that it is, that once the show gets going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feel like you're just having a conversation or like your uncle's, you know, just talking to you.
Just Uncle Dick, just on
stage. Yeah, right, there you go. So,
I love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah,
how do you prepare for that? Because I mean, clearly you said you've known his work and comedy and everything since you were, you know, a teenager.
Yeah.
Did you go back and watch a lot of his stuff on YouTube? Did you read his? He had that very famous autobiography with a very provocative title. Yeah. Did you? Yeah. How did you actually go back there and, you know, dig through that?
Yeah.
Replicate it.
Well, kind of got to give some context to it. And so let me do it this way. I've been living in Paris for the past year, working with a famous director there, Peter Brook. And so I hadn't been in the States. So I didn't know that show existed.
Right. Okay.
So I came back to the States in April. I was doing a show in Chicago and I got a phone call about this show. And I said, of course I'm interested. Then I got a phone call a few days later saying, okay, it's yours. And I was like, okay, cool.
Wow.
As far as research, I try not to research characters. I always say, even if the script is bad, everything I need is in the text.
Mm-hmm.
Playing an actual person is very, very different. So I didn't really look at much stuff about him because it's not about trying to mimic him. It's about trying to find the essence of who he was.
Right.
And allowing that to be seen and to celebrate him in a way, which is kind of my approach to playing actual people. But I watched a few things. I didn't read the books because I knew about them already.
Mm-hmm.
But just try to, it's so funny. The way I prepared the most is by just trying to stay out of the way. You know, just trying to stay out of the way, not do my thing, but to just kind of let the character find me, because that's always my approach. Just let the character find me, and to take what I knew, what I understood about him, because I'm always watching videos of him anyway.
Sure.
How'd
you prepare? Well, I do what I always do.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's just what it is. Yeah. But I really just try to stay out of the way, not get ahead of the process and the piece. And that sounds very actor-y thing, and I'm the furthest thing from an actor.
That's what we're doing. We're talking actor-y things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh boy. Nobody wants to see that. But I didn't call anyone. I didn't try to meet anyone. I listened to what everyone else had to say. I had my own ideas about him. Some things I had to put away. Some things I thought I wanted to really, really bump and push. But through the process, it just started to come.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, for me, the best way to just kind of move, is to just not try to do it all up front.
Right.
Because that can get you tired.
Right.
You know, and to not try to mimic him, because no one wants to see that either.
Right. You're never going to beat him anyway.
Right.
Make your own. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is that the more I listen to the piece, the more this thing starts to happen in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so just kind of trust that process and just let it go. It's just been so, it's fun. It continues to be fun every day.
That's great.
Yeah. Even when I don't land something, I'm like, okay, okay, let's do it again.
Absolutely. Well, so that was sort of all about the performance, and we're sort of up against the clock a little, but time a little bit. I before we go, tell me about the creators of this. I know Arena puts on a lot of new shows, but has this been around for, how long has this been around?
I think a couple of years.
Two or three years. It started on Broadway or? Off-Broadway? Okay. Yeah, well, and is it true John Legend was a piece of, like, co-producing it? Okay,
yeah, he's
okay.
Producer on it. Yeah, well, I think they first did the show in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And then it came back to New York at the West Side Theater there. John Gould Rubin is the director, and Gretchen Law is the writer, along with Dick Gregory.
let's face it.
let's be honest about that. Yeah, so Joe Morton, who plays, everyone knows him as Papa Pope mm-hmm. on Scandal. Joe Morton was doing the role.
Oh, cool.
First.
He originated it.
Yeah, he originated it.
Well, Dick Gregory originated it.
Well, yeah, right. and then he had to go back on to Scandal. Mm-hmm. And so I received a phone call.
So like, hey, there's that guy in Paris we think can do it.
Well, yeah, a buddy, well, guy I worked with in New York a lot, Jack Doolin at New York Theater Workshop. I worked with him a lot over the years. I was doing a play in Chicago, and Jack calls me up one day, Edwin, it's Jack. And so, you know, whenever Jack calls me, the answer is always yes first. Mm-hmm. Then I find out, you know, what it is. So, you know, he asked me about this, if I'd be interested. And I was like, yeah, I'd be interested. And then, like I said, about 3 or 4 days later, he called me back and said, okay, it's yours. So it's one of those things I think that, like, found me. Mm-hmm. Because I had just been saying that I, you know, that I wanted to do some heavy lifting. The show I was doing in Chicago, I didn't feel like it was really heavy lifting for me. I was thankful for the job, but I didn't think it was like, you know, I didn't feel like I was doing enough work.
Right.
So then this pops up, and okay, yeah, you know, it's definitely heavy lifting. So yeah,
all the good ones are, you know,
a
little challenge means you're on the right path.
Yeah.
All right, so final question. Yeah, I mean, just bring it full circle. Mm-hmm. Why should our listeners come out to the show? Whether they are, you know, diehard Dick Gregory fans and can quote all of, you know, the routines, or maybe they're young and maybe have heard the name but don't know anything about him. You know, whatever, you know, wherever they fall. Why should they come out to this show? What are they going to get out of it?
Yeah. Well, you know, I always feel like there should be an ample number of people that regularly attend the theater sitting next to people that don't regularly attend the theater. Right. I think that's how the art grows. That's how the theater grows.
Right.
The choir is cool, but we need to get other people that don't normally go.
Right.
And I think this is an opportunity for that, to learn a lot of history, not in... some way that's like heavy-handed,
right?
But you also learn history of the country, you learn history of comedy, in a modern comedy, and the universal aesthetics, you know, that we all share. So I think people should come out because it's fun, and it's a beautiful evening. I think it's a beautiful evening, and it's sometimes you go to places and you're like, wow, I can't get that hour and a half back. Mm-hmm. I don't think you'll feel that way in this piece.
We'll say I want to go relive that hour and a half.
Yeah. It's a celebration of a person, and it's a celebration, or I should say, it's a look into what our potential is as a country. And there's people that inhabit this country that are, you know, differently hued, you know. It's all about what can be done.
Yeah.
If we decide, you know, but it's not in a very it's not in some preachy kind of way. Mm-hmm. It's not that at all. It's quite a beautiful kind of a rendition and a story of a beautiful cat. That I loved, you know, that was, you know, who loved humanity. And I think that's something everybody can get something out of, because we've had things like that already. The audiences have been as young as they've been older. And that's been really, really great to see, you know, the reaction to one person doing most of this work, but also the story itself.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, this has been beautiful too. I knew if I just turned you loose, you could do it.
Oh wow! Look, I see what you did there. I see
again,
what you did there.
It's called "Turn Me Loose." Now through October 14th at Arena Stage, the
Dig
Gregory Story. Thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Dig it. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks.
All right.